This BizNews briefing is brought to you by Investec Business Banking. Make the move to transactional banking with simple, transparent fees.
It's Wednesday, the 23rd of April. This is your BizNews briefing. I'm Bronwyn Nielsen. In our lead story, regular BizNews premium contributor R.W. Johnson, in a provocative piece, examines claims circulating in Trumpist circles about expelling South Africa from the G20, citing its relatively small GDP and alleged ties to state-sponsored terrorism. He delves into the controversial reappointment of Ibrahim Rasool as South Africa's ambassador to the US, highlighting his documented connections to Hamas, Hezbollah, and other Islamist groups. Let's take a listen.
There is apparently discussion in Trumpist circles in Washington of expelling South Africa from the G20. It is pointed out that South Africa has the smallest GDP of any member, and that many countries who are not G20 members actually have far greater economic weight than South Africa. What this points to is that South Africa was included merely in order to have token African representation. This is no doubt an alarming thought for Pretoria, but more alarming still is the suggestion, also made in Trumpist circles, that South Africa might be found guilty of state-sponsored terrorism, which would automatically disqualify it, not merely from the G20, but from all manner of other bodies as well. What is the evidence for such an accusation? One might start with the figure of Ibrahim Rasool, who was re-elected as South Africa's ambassador in Washington in 2025, after an earlier tour during 2010 to 2015. During Rasool's first tour as South Africa's ambassador to the US, he devoted a great deal of his time and energy to organizing Islamist-run American Muslim associations. Rasool is also active in international Islamist circles and has strong links to the Pakistani Jamaat-e-Islami, which was responsible for the mass murder of Bangladeshis during the 1971 War of Independence. Indeed, so active was Rasool in international Islamist circles that his official duties as South Africa's ambassador often seemed to take second place. Remarkably, the South African authorities seemed happy with this. Given this record, many commentators warned that Rasool was a most unwise choice as ambassador in 2025, for he was unlikely to be palatable to the Trump administration. All such warnings were ignored, for the fact is that South Africa's foreign ministry, DIRCO, which had chosen Rasool, was itself hardly neutral on the subject of Islamist influence. In fact, Rasool was almost immediately expelled from the US in disgrace after he had most undiplomatically described President Trump as a white supremacist. The fact that DIRCO had strong Islamist leanings derived from the ANC's struggle history. During its long years of exile, the ANC moved considerably to the left. At the same time, the ANC established fraternal relations with a number of revolutionary third world movements, including the PLO, Gaddafi's Libya, the Algerian FLN, and the Muslim radicals of South Yemen. In general, this fitted with the ANC's anti-Western bias. In effect, the ANC followed Soviet policy, which treated both Israel and South Africa as pariah states. The Iranian Revolution of 1979 was also strongly welcomed by the ANC as a major blow against American imperialism. The plight of Palestinian refugees is, of course, an entirely respectable humanitarian cause, but the ANC tends to conflate its humanitarian concerns with full-on support for Hamas and Hezbollah. This was made obvious during its court action accusing Israel of genocide before the International Court of Justice, launched by Naledi Pandor, the DIRCO minister, from 2019 to June 2024. Pandor had converted to Islam in order to marry Sharif Pandor and has hold the seal of a convert. She made no secret of her sympathies for Hamas, and during the ICJ action, Hamas and Hezbollah representatives toured South Africa, where they were treated as VIPs. Moreover, shortly before court proceedings at the ICJ began, South Africa's legal team was whisked away to meet secretly with Palestinian terrorist activists, a meeting arranged by DIRCO. This poses many questions. How, after all, would Hamas and Hezbollah fighters get to The Hague? Quite probably on false Iranian passports, which in turn suggests that this meeting was arranged in collaboration with Iran. But it is also perfectly illustrative of the fact that while South Africa was putting its case to the ICJ, supposedly on humanitarian grounds, in fact, the ANC conflates that with actively supporting Hamas and Hezbollah. The fact that adoption of the pro-Hamas cause has already had such serious consequences has only strengthened the secrecy surrounding South Africa's relations with Iran and its proxies. What is publicly known is that South Africa's MTN is one of the biggest investors in Iran, owning 49% of one of the main telecoms there. MTN has been accused of paying bribes to the Taliban and Al-Qaeda and facilitating terror attacks in Iran and Afghanistan. Ramaphosa is a past chairman of MTN, and its present chairman, Imhlabisi Jonas, now faces the embarrassment of a US lawsuit under the Anti-Terrorism Act, in which it is alleged that MTN's collaboration with the Iranian Revolutionary Guard was responsible for the deaths of many US servicemen in Iraq. None of this proves that South Africa has been directly sponsoring terrorism, though the consistent pattern of pro-Hamas, pro-Hezbollah, and pro-Iranian contacts and behavior also suggests that this is far from impossible. So much is hidden from view. It is remarkable that militant Islamists regard South Africa as one of the strongest supporters of their cause, ahead of many Arab nations. Only 3% of South Africa's population are Muslims, after all. Equally remarkable, though, is the way that the ANC has been content to see Durko become an Islamist stronghold. During the negotiations for the GNU, the ANC went to great lengths to ensure that the DA was kept well away from Durko. One can see why. That department is the keeper of no end of political and financial secrets.
A strong legal challenge is being launched against the government's new racial hiring policies, effectively prohibiting companies with 50 or more employees to appoint white males beyond a certain level. Chris Steyn spoke to Saka Liga CEO Pete LaRue on what LaRue calls a form of expropriation and targeted economic sanctions. Let's dip into the conversation.
We cannot let the state dictate to companies how they should employ. This is in effect a form of expropriation, because some of these quotas go as far. For example, in agriculture, it says that top management may be a maximum of 2/3 white. Now, in some farms with 50 or more employees, the top management is the farmer. And this means effectively he's already over quota. He can now not appoint his son to manage the farm with him. So it's a very nice sounding way, but in effect a cruel and cool, chilling way of telling a farmer that there's no place for his son on the team. And this is, of course, for farming businesses, but the quotas are even more strict in other sectors of the economy. And so this is, in effect, a form of expropriation, or if you will, targeted economic sanctions on a section of the domestic population.
What do you think America will make of this, considering its disapproval of our race-based laws?
Foreign companies face very big problems under these regulations, and not only because it harms their South African ability to do business, the ability to do business in South Africa, but it also exposes them, to the extent that they try to comply, to potential violations of their own legal systems in their own jurisdictions and their own ethical obligations elsewhere. For example, several stock exchanges in the world have, as an ethical component, it discourages or even prohibits racial discrimination. And arguably, you, by conducting yourself in accordance with what this legislation requires now of you in South Africa, you expose yourself to a complaint at another stock exchange, so let's say a listing requirement, or potentially a legal requirement in your home jurisdiction of being in violation of what is ethically or legally required of you. So this is a very complicated legal risk vectors opening up to these international businesses. I think this will trouble just the businesses themselves very much. I think we should expect not only the United States businesses operating in South Africa, but other businesses picking up that phone and sending that email to their embassies and trade attachés, asking them how to advise on how to deal with this. This is definitely oil on the fire of South African international trade relations. And well, how else do you explain this as a very targeted sanction against a section of your population based on race and sex? In the US, they call this DEI, diversity, equity, or equality and inclusion, some version of that. And from an international perspective, what's happening now in South Africa looks like the most extreme version of DEI all over the world. And that is where they will categorize this in their legal and compliance risk vectors, in their country risk assessments. And this is also the banner under which they will ask for assistance and guidance from their home jurisdictions And I cannot see how this can find any favor with the United States administration right now.
That full interview is available on the BizNews TV YouTube platform. I spoke to Kevin Lings, chief economist at Stanlib, who says that as a result of all the noise around South Africa, investors see SA as uninvestable, especially given the choice they have when it comes to other, much more attractive emerging markets.
And we're quite quickly moving into a phase where we're looking back and saying, we've lost the opportunity. The problem is that when you've got a government debt of 76% of GDP, you don't get many opportunities. The opportunities run out. If your government debt was 20 or 30% of GDP, you could say, well, no, another opportunity will present itself. No, not in this environment. You can see how competitive the world has become, how difficult our turmoil has become. We had an opportunity. It was within our grasp, and we've let that slip. And all of that just means we got a harder job to try and get the growth rate going. And more, I worry that people are just accepting, oh, the growth rate's almost 2%. That's good. And they're kind of nodding along with that. 2%, or not being funny, is hopeless in the South African context. You're not going to improve people's lives with 2% GDP growth.
But it's not 2%. We've got to double that. I mean, we're saying already everyone's looking at closer to 1%. So, I mean, anybody who's thinking of 2% is in la la land.
Exactly. So, but when people put up 2%, it's like they feel that that's an accomplishment. We were in an environment of 3% growth not that long ago, and we even said then 3% is just not good enough. And so we've kind of capitulated on this, and now we're more accepting of, well, we've got some positive growth. The problem is it's not improving people's lives. It's not dealing with the population growth. It's not dealing with the unemployment. And so In another year's time, I think we'll be debating the same thing. Revenue shortfall that we didn't get. How do we collect more revenue? Are we going to go with this tax hike or that tax hike? We've still got the infrastructure shortfalls. It all just languishes, and we don't have that time. We don't have the benefit of just endless time, years go by, where we're not developing South Africa.
It's jobs. And if we don't grow, we cannot create employment. And if we don't create employment, we're going to continue with the inequality that South Africa is now famous for. And that brings instability, Kevin.
So absolutely. So think about, put it in context, think about young people who are leaving school, leaving university, and are want a future for themselves. What would you tell them? What realistic would you suggest they should do in terms of how do they go about finding jobs, careers, opportunities, skills development? So the years go by and we're not dealing with that. So there's a massive opportunity cost that's going on in South Africa. And quite frankly, now we look back at it and it's 15 years. We're starting to get into, we've lost a generation of opportunity. It just feels to me that we don't have the right sense of urgency, that tomorrow's fine, the next week, the next month, everything just drags on. And we don't have that luxury. So at this stage, a bit despondent. I can see what would need to be done. I think that's not difficult. I think many people come up with the same conclusions. I think that's encouraging. The people that look at South Africa and suggest what we can do, they all reach similar conclusions. So I think there's a good understanding of what we need to do. There's just there isn't a political will to implement that assertively and with a sense of urgency.
You chat to a lot of foreign investors. Are they giving up on us?
So when the sentiment changed with South Africa, unfortunately, when the Trump administration vocalized a negative view on South Africa. Before that, I think there was a reasonable degree of optimism. There was certainly an expectation that the GNU would help. But I was on a particular investor call with some people in Washington shortly after Trump started to vocalize his displeasure with South Africa, and that came up as a topic. And normally, South Africa is not mentioned in those types of investor calls directly. And the conclusion from that is South Africa is uninvestable. It wasn't that they felt that Trump was correct or that what Trump was saying was absolutely valid. It wasn't that. It was that the investor's got a wide range of opportunities when you go, especially into emerging markets. South Africa is one of many choices they've got. So why pick a country where, you know, the president of the United States has taken a particularly negative interest in? You would go to a different destination. And I think that's done quite a lot of damage to us in terms of foreign investor sentiment. Subsequent to that, obviously, all of the stuff around the fiscal framework, the problem with the voting around it, that hasn't helped at all.
In the world of business banking, the bottom line can often triumph over relationships. At Investec, we value both. Make the move from business as usual to Investec Business Banking. Out of the ordinary.
At SunExchange, we make going solar simple, profitable, and completely risk-free. Join over 100 satisfied South African customers already enjoying the benefits of risk-free solar. Start saving today. Visit sunexchange.com and join the solar revolution.
Political scientist Dr. Franz Cronier recently returned from a trip to the US, and Alec Hogg caught up with him to get his reading of the room when it comes to current US-SA relations.
It's interesting, viz Africa broadly, because the response of a lot of Africa to Mr. Trump's trade moves was read by the Americans as being very positive. Good relations with the DRC, good relations with Rwanda, Mozambique, others. South Africa, standout, case of the opposite. I mean, even little Lesotho, which apparently no one can find on a map, even little Lesotho was spoken of in favorable terms. The Zimbabweans had reached out to say, hey, let's do a deal. But opinion on South Africa and its approach wasn't good. South Africa at this time does not have a single senior diplomat in America capable of talking to anyone senior. My understanding is that the United States would be delighted to come to terms with South Africa and strike some sort of deal, whatever form that may take. And I think from South Africa's perspective, that's very important, even just from the ANC's perspective. For the ANC to survive, let's just talk about America from the ANC perspective, do something unusual. To survive, because that's where it's at now. The rate of fixed investment must lift very quickly. Now, the United States has the economic firepower and the dollar at this morning, probably again, just under 19 to 1, goes a long way. The potential, therefore, of interesting the U.S. in South African infrastructure, minerals, the like, as part of its broader approach to Southern Africa is immense. But you don't even have a single person there who over recent weeks has been able to talk to anyone in that regard. I think many of the delegations that have gone to from South Africa have misread the room. There's no point in going in this climate and talking about South Africa's history or that it deserves help and support. As one quite senior chap put it to me, we don't care. Go home to these delegations, come back when you've got a plan or a deal that you want to do with us. There is strategic importance in South Africa, though, for the US. It's one of the 3 points that anchors Simonstown, anchors control of the Indo-Pacific. The sea channel around the Cape is very, very narrow. After the fall of Singapore and Hong Kong in the Second World War, we saw massive lift in sea traffic around the Cape. We've seen the same thing now because of what the Houthis are doing at the gateway into the Red Sea and then Suez beyond that. But South Africans can't be complacent because the Americans have fantastic fallback positions in Southern Africa. Angola is hosting the US-Africa Business Summit is not involved in some absurd diplomatic spat that it couldn't possibly succeed in winning. There are very interesting plans afoot for minerals exchanges in Southern Africa that South Africa is not necessarily going to be part of. One of our great interests is a future transatlantic alliance, and we would love that alliance to be between the US, the UK, Argentina, and South Africa. But you're told no way. The alliance, those countries, and Angola, that's the alliance. So there's...
Are we getting cut out? We're getting cut out of a very potentially lucrative partnership.
If you're... You know, and people may have the views that they have personally of Mr. Trump if they wish to. But there are hard realities. And if you spend your time insulting him and have no one in America to talk for you, then I don't know if you could say they've cut you out. You've cut yourself up.
Again, that full interview is available on BizNews TV YouTube platform. Now, Tesla reported adjusted earnings of 27 cents per share for the first quarter, below the average analyst estimate. The share jumped 10% post-market close. Morningstar's Seth Goldstein says that Tesla's long-term strategy is on track.
Seth, on the surface, these comments aren't totally surprising. We've kind of known the bind that Tesla has been in, both because of economic conditions, but also, of course, let's just say some of the political conditions as well. What was your first take when you saw these numbers?
Well, you know, we knew with deliveries being down 13% year over year that the financial results would likely follow that and give us more detail. Obviously, for automakers, when you have lower production and lower volumes, you're going to see a bigger profit hit as well. So a lot of the numbers were not surprising. What I was really focused on is what's the outlook and what's the outlook for more affordable vehicles. We saw a media report earlier this weekend that said the affordable vehicle would be delayed until either later this year or even early 2026. In the deck I just read, Tesla's saying they're still on track to begin production by the first half of 2025 for the more affordable vehicle. So I'd like to hear more on the earnings call later tonight, what management plans to do, if there's an update timeline for when those deliveries will begin. I also wanted to see if they were going to be still on track with the launch of the autonomous vehicle, the testing they're going to do in Austin, Texas, still on track for that. So, you know, despite a lot of the tariff-related near-term uncertainty, I think Tesla's long-term growth strategy remains on track, and that was reassuring to see.
Well, what does that, though, look like? So, I mean, let's first take the autonomous vehicle for one. I mean, they kind of say that they're still on pace for what they call volume production starting in 2026. So that's still less than basically a year away at most. Do you have confidence that they can meet that target?
I'm forecasting they're going to be launching their autonomous vehicle Robotaxi service by 2028. I think that when you look at the full self-driving software as measured by the miles per intervention, meaning when the software system stops working and a human has to take over, they're still well below the 10,000 miles per disengagement threshold that we need to see to offer a robo-taxi service. So I want to hear from management tonight where they're at with that progress. But I don't think the FST software is going to be there by 2026. So I think even if they can begin producing the Cybercab next year, I wouldn't expect to see it on the streets for another couple years after that, which is how I get to my 2028 forecast.
And so with regards to the other vehicles that may or may not be coming, because there's been a lot of discussion, Seth, about this idea that some of its models now, at least in terms of design, are a little stale, for lack of a better word. They've been out there for a while. Maybe that's a more better way of putting it. So people are looking for whether there's going to be a refresh or something completely new, and something ideally that's not the Cybertruck.
That's right. And we saw the new Model Y, I think, was a big drag on first quarter deliveries because it wasn't out yet in many of Tesla's key markets. It wasn't really out till March in the U.S., only in a select number of European countries, and just starting to get out in March in China as well. So I think that really dragged down the first quarter deliveries. But now that the new Model Y is being produced and being sold in the three key markets for Tesla, I think we'll see in Q2 if, you know, how much of the deliveries decline was consumers waiting for a new model? How much are consumers waiting and not buying a Model Y for the more affordable model? Or is there political risk, and especially in the U.S. and Europe, associated with Tesla that's causing many consumers to seek alternative vehicles?
Well, I mean, just looking at this deck, Seth, I mean, they include a great chart in here that kind of shows you that political risk here. Three lines, the U.S., Europe, and China, in terms of its market share of Tesla vehicles by region. All of them have basically flatlined, but none more so than what we're seeing in Europe and China right now.
That's right. And you know, I think a lot of what we saw in China could be attributed to waiting for the full self-driving to be approved. We saw week over week orders immediately start to improve once they received that approval to launch the full self-driving software, because for many consumers in China today, they need a car to have the autonomous driving, the level two software. And so if Tesla did not have that approval, many consumers were holding off on Tesla vehicles. So we'll have to see how that market progresses in the second quarter and beyond. For Europe, there's still a big question to me whether consumers are waiting for the new Model Y or whether Elon Musk, you know, campaigning in the recent German elections turned some consumers away. And I think that'll be answered throughout the year, especially in Q2 as well, now that the new Model Y is launched.
And President Trump pledges to be very good to China. Responding to reporters in the White House, Trump says he did not anticipate a hardball negotiation with Beijing. Trump predicts the final tariff on China would not be anywhere near the 145% level he has set. Separately, Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent says the tariff standoff cannot be sustained and that both Beijing and Washington will have to find ways to de-escalate very shortly.
We're going to be very nice. They're going to be very nice. And we'll see what happens. But ultimately, they have to make a deal. 145% is very high, and it won't be that high. I think we'll make a deal with China.
President Trump on his hopes for a trade deal with China. Our China correspondent Min Min Lo joins us now from Hong Kong. I mean, Min Min, what does being very nice with China even mean? Where are we in these negotiations?
Yeah, so reporters actually asked President Trump, will he play hardball with China? And he said no. And this is really an interesting turn of the narrative here. President Trump saying that the final tariffs for China will be quite far away from, well, will not be near to the 145% tariff so far, but it won't be zero as well. He says China will be very happy with the final deal, but they have to make the deal. And then he said if China doesn't, then the US will set the deal. So certainly the window for that potential deal seems to be opening up just a little bit wider. And this comes as Scott Bessent, the Treasury Secretary, also said in a closed-door investment summit hosted by JP Morgan Chase that this standoff between US and China is not sustainable. And he said both sides will have to find a way to de-escalate. And the timing, he said, is going to be in the very near future. Although he cautioned that any sort of big comprehensive deal is going to take a long time, possibly 2 to 3 years to iron out. And he continued to reiterate the contention that China is favoring its own manufacturing at US expense. So any deal will have to rebalance trade and bring manufacturing back to the US. But again, look, President Trump has been known to eat his own words. We look at what he had said about Jay Powell recently. So it's really hard to discern sometimes whether it's just a throwaway comment to shore up markets or is this really a shift in his stance and his openness to strike a deal with China.
That brings us to the end of this BizNews briefing. We'll be back tomorrow with more context, both local and global. Thanks as always for watching.
This BizNews briefing is brought to you by Investec Business Banking. Make the move to finance solutions that enable real growth.